Auto Line After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone. Your journey, our passion.
This is Auto Line After Hours with John McElroy, episode 222 for December 13th, 2013. Inside GM, the story you haven't heard. Watch Autoline After Hours live at autoline.tv every Thursday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time or 2300 GMT. You can subscribe to this podcast for free by searching for Autoline in iTunes, Stitcher, or by following the links on our website. Mr. Peter DeLorenzo.
Hey, John.
How you doing?
I'm doing well.
Boy, we got a lot to talk to about tonight.
Really?
Yeah.
About what?
Oh, we'll get to that in a minute, but let's let everybody else know who's... Yeah, the weather. That's Gary Vasilash, Automotive Design and Production Magazine. Great having you, as always, Gary. And we got Peter's cousin, Matt DeLorenzo, now with Kelley Blue Book.
Yep.
And Matt, great having you here with us, man.
Great to be here.
So, Peter, I got to ask you what everybody in this business is asking about the column that you wrote. We should backtrack a little bit. Boy, is GM in the news this week. And we'll get into some of the other stuff. But, of course, the big story is Dan Akerson announcing he's going to retire next month and giving the CEO job to Mary Barra.
Well, orchestrated the board to do his bidding, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, and this has been in the works for some time. We started seeing the stories being planted in the Wall Street Journal about a year ago, 10 months ago, you know. And then, you know, the Dan Akerson is a visionary story, and then he's looking for a change agent to replace him. And then Mary Barra's name surfaced along with some others, but... And then we're getting word that there's a magazine article coming out tomorrow in print. That's clearly been, the magazine was clearly in on this 5 or 6 weeks ago. So
it sounds like the press has been sitting on this announcement, or at least this is Bloomberg you're talking
about.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's interesting. I mean, you know, Mary, Dan gave Mary the product development chief title a while ago, but that wasn't ever her role in the company. Her role was when the product development people finished with a vehicle that was ready to be executed, they gave it to Mary, and she knew the system enough to get it done in the most efficient way possible. But leading product development, that was Mark Royce. So, but I think... despite what Dan says in public, he's not a fan of the car business. He's not a fan of cars. He's not a fan of car guys or car girls, much to, you know, the
difference. This is very true. And yeah. I've had other people very well connected within General Motors tell me the exact same thing. In fact, the way I heard it described is there was a wall between the car people and the others that came.
And he was going to do his damnedest to prevent... the guy who led the True Believers in product development, Mark Royce, from ascending. And so he orchestrated this whole thing on his way out the door.
So your point, though, was that the best choice was not made.
No, the best choice is...
That's the...
You know, I don't care if the name was Mark Barra. You know, my column...
You're not picking on her because she's a woman.
No. I mean, should a woman run a car company? Absolutely. And maybe Mary would have been perfectly fine for that, you know, down the road a bit, 5 years, I don't know. But it wasn't the best person roaming the halls of GM, in my estimation. And people started to come after me saying, oh, he just didn't want to. No, that had nothing to do with it. If the name was Mark Barra and given the people on the table to be considered, it's still Mark Royce. So
one of the things that I think really caught my eye and everybody else's was in your column, you were talking about how Ackerson would berate Mark Royce in meetings and even talked down his father, Lloyd Royce, behind, a former president of GM.
Behind Mark's back, yeah. I mean, this is kind of low life.
No, I mean, you're getting this from good sources. Yeah, you're on solid ground and talking about
this. Yes, low life juvenile.
Because these are serious charges you're making here.
Low life juvenile stuff. Like, I likened it to Niedermeyer in Animal House. I mean, you know, it's just, he was hell-bent on keeping Mark Royce from ever gaining favor in the executive suite, and he did it. He pulled it off.
The one good thing, I think, though, is Royce is in charge of all product development now, with purchasing reporting to him. I mean, in a way, he's got the best job, because now he doesn't have to deal with Wall Street, the bankers, the financial community, all that stuff, and can concentrate on product.
Yeah, and the smartest thing Miss Barra can do, as I was admonished by a very pissed off woman who wrote me, the best thing Miss Barra can do is let Mark Royce do his thing.
Sure.
And that would be, if I were in her shoes, that would be, you know, job one.
Well, I think it's interesting, too, though she got the CEO position.
She did not get the chairman.
She did not get chairman, which actually I think is a really good thing. That should have been how it was all the way, because under the old Rick Wagner regime, he was chairman of the board and CEO of the company. And the board rubber stamped a bunch of bonehead decisions, a bunch of them. And I always felt that you should separate those two jobs. You know, the board's job is to oversee management. So management shouldn't be part of the board. The board can summon them anytime it wants and get all the answers it wants. And the other thing that's interesting is Dan Ammann, the CFO, was given the position of president. So I think that's a recognition that Mary Barra probably isn't the right person to deal with the financial community. They're going to let Dan Ammann handle that. So just a lot of interesting changes. Personally, I think Ammann, Barra, and Royce could be a dynamite team.
Well, I think that that's one of the things that you have to give it time and see what sort of chemistry works out between the three of them. And I think one of the major things is doing a turnaround, as difficult as it is, I think is not as hard as managing success. And that's where GM is right now. They're on the cusp of success. And they can manage it and do well with it, or they could toss it all away like they've done so many times before. And it's going to be absolutely critical that these three people get on the same page, stay on the same page, and try to work together as smoothly as possible.
That's a great point. Managing success is more difficult. You know, when everything's broken.
The question is, I mean, how much momentum does General Motors have right now? I mean, are we convinced that there's enough going forward that two or three years from now, they're going to be in a good position in terms of the market?
No, there's big question marks.
Right. Yeah. So then it raises the question of, okay, if, you know, Ackerson and the board have fiduciary responsibility to the shareholders to find the best talent in the world to run the corporation, right? And now that the government is out of General Motors, presumably this means the salary caps are off the table. So is the search that was made for his successor as aggressive as, say, the search that's being made for Steve Ballmer's successor at Microsoft? And I was interested. I was looking at the board, the GM board makeup today, and then out of curiosity, I looked at the Microsoft board makeup today. And I just was, you know, sort of curious to see, okay, how does somebody in a different industry deal with this? And I was surprised and have a bit of admiration that there are actually two tech company CEOs on the Microsoft board. Okay. There's no supplier company or related person on the General Motors board. So here are people here that sort of understand the business. And I'm not so sure that these people that are on the GM board really understand the business. So, you know, I get back to
this. Well, one exception, the new chairman is a guy from Cummins.
Right.
Chairman and CEO, ex-chairman and CEO of Cummins. So They were never a supplier to GM.
Right. But isn't he, he's retired.
He's retired, but I don't think he's that old. I want to say he's like 66 or something like that.
Which is relevant now.
Yeah. Well, that's all relevant. But I mean, recently retired.
Yes.
You know, not some old fogey. But my big complaint with the GM board and in fact, every automotive board is they don't have anybody who came up on the sales or retail side of the business, of the automotive business.
Right.
I think GM's got a telephone salesman or two in there right now. But that's not the same as retailing a big ticket item like a car. Understanding the wholesale and the retail distribution, you know, all the different regions, the way the whole system works, that's really complicated. And in fact, most people, and I'm first example, most people that are in or cover the business don't know how it works either. And I'm just so curious why an automotive company wouldn't have somebody like that on their board. A Roger Penske, a Mike Jackson at AutoNation, you know, Earl Hesterberg, you know, why you wouldn't have someone like that on your board, I find very puzzling.
Yeah. Well, it'll be interesting. I think, you know, GM's on a product roll right now, clearly.
In the U.S.
Yeah. I think GM design is the best in the business right now. Certainly equal to any of the other considered best in the business. And so if they can keep it together, we'll see. I mean, the next 3 years are pivotal.
But Gary raised a really good question. You know, looking 3 years out and then look globally, Europe is still a mess. And what do you all make of Chevrolet being yanked out of Europe? What's that about?
Well, I mean, they were beating that dead horse for a long time. The question is Opel going to end up on the Man U uniforms along with the Chevy bow tie? I figure that's probably coming. And then they're pulling out of the Peugeot thing.
Well, yeah. That's another fiasco.
That was a huge mistake. Because you already had European operations. So, one, you're mucking it up by bringing in a domestic, U.S. perceived domestic brand. The second thing is you get in bed with a partner that's in worse shape than Opel. And you kind of cut Opel off at the knees. So I'm kind of encouraged by the recent moves. And to your point, Gary, about saying, do they have momentum? I don't think it's so much momentum as that they don't have the baggage of $50 billion of debt holding them back. So now that that's been cleared away, the question going forward is, are they going to start racking up losses again? And if the losses in Europe are big, it could really impact what's going on in North America and what's going to happen with China. I mean, those are the two big questions hanging out there.
And it's also interesting that among the other changes at GM, Stephen Gursky was sort of demoted.
Mm-hmm. Well, he wasn't demoted. He's essentially being pushed out.
Yeah.
He's going to stay on the board, as I keep adding, for the time being.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think that, you know, the Chevrolet move, the Opel fiasco, the PSA fiasco. I mean, here GM pours $400 million into that. And all of us at the time were going, what are you thinking? I mean, all your other alliances with Suzuki and Isuzu and Subaru and Toyota and on ended in total, if they didn't end in disaster, they did nothing for the company. And so why were they doing the same thing with Peugeot? And now they're going to, they had to write off that investment. Now they're dumping all their share.
And the interesting thing is in the release today about that, it said something along the lines of, but we will continue to cooperate them and share platforms and share development and so on. So why didn't they just do that?
To begin with.
Yeah. And I mean, yeah. and
you didn't
save
have to
them,
give them $400 million.
Yeah, save some
that.
Money.
You know, the other thing is that you didn't have to go back very far in GM history to see another deal like that, and that was that Fiat Diesel engine deal less than 10 years ago.
Well, actually,
and they ended up losing money on it.
I actually think that they used that money to buy Chrysler.
Yeah.
They just kept it in a little vault, and then Sergio used it to pay for Chrysler when they had to come up with the first payment.
Yeah.
But you think there'd be enough institutional memory around GM saying, hey, haven't we been down this road with a European maker before?
Well, this is my read of the situation. This is exactly why they yanked all operations away from Steve Gursky. Gursky, you know, I know him going back, man, probably to the late 80s or something like that. The guy is really smart, you know, a brilliant analyst. He was voted like the best Wall Street analyst, I don't know, 14 years in a row or something like that. But just because you're good at analysis doesn't mean you're good at running operations. And I think this is why they've yanked all operations away. You can sit on the board, you know, you can help us oversee things, but clearly, you know, GM Europe, Opel, and PSA blew up in his face.
And another big thing this week, the announcement about pulling out of Australia in terms of...
Yeah, Holden.
Yeah, manufacturing and...
Where are those poor Australians going to get their utes?
Where are we going to get... where the SS is going to come
from? I mean, they're...
Yeah, well, that's the big question.
They're effectively... I mean, the automobile industry in Australia is basically...
Done.
They're just going to import now.
Yeah.
Well, there's one last manufacturer,
Toyota.
Yeah. But even Toyota put out a release going, geez, guys, I don't know. You know, Ford pulls out, now GM's pulling out. We use much of the same supplier base. They're all going to collapse with missing that volume. So to me, it's an easy prediction, you know, and just that's probably it. Weeks, Toyota's going to announce it's closing up shop there too.
See, but it wouldn't surprise me if a Chinese company doesn't set up shop in Australia and say, we're with you guys. They all pulled out, we're here.
Good luck.
Because, I mean, they sell cars. I
they
mean,
sell cars.
They sell their cars there now. Right, right, sure. So they'll have the money. They could eat losses.
I understand. I was talking to somebody yesterday that there's some government rule, though, that if you have manufacturing operations, the government wants you to export up to 30, or to export at least 30% of that volume.
Send them to generate. China.
Yeah, well...
Where they can disassemble them and put them in other CKD kits.
I think part of it is self-inflicted on the part of the, you know, the Australian government.
Well, the big thing is Australia has the population of the states of Michigan and Ohio combined.
Yeah.
It's got a population of around 20 million, a little over that. And, you know, the fact of the matter is you just cannot support an automotive industry with such a small sales base. I mean, Canada's like, what, closer to 40 million? You know, and, you know, there's no way that Australia could have pulled this off unless and as long as it kept very restrictive import restraints and tariffs. Then, yeah, if you had no choice but to buy from Holden or Ford or going back when to Chrysler, then Mitsubishi, now Toyota. But that's the only way it could have happened. Yeah. But, yeah, what about the SS? What's GM going to do with all those Holdens and fantastic rear drive cars that they build there?
I'm betting that they end up in Oshawa,
because, Canada.
Because there's the other thing that they do at Holden is they export that platform to the Middle East. So they have both the short wheelbase, which is the SS, and then the longer wheelbase one is the PPV.
Mm-hmm.
And again,
they ship to China as well.
Yeah.
There's the Commodore is sold as a Buick in China.
So I think that there could be some real advantages to North American sourcing of that. And then it opens up some of these police fleets and things like that that have American or North American only products.
And I think that business in the Middle East used to be Chevy business.
Right.
Basically from here, you know, sending over Caprices and...
Well, no, they would build them in Port Elizabeth and send them.
Oh, I thought they were building them here.
No, they kept the Caprice name and...
No. I mean,
oh,
before Holden got the business.
Oh, okay.
That it was...
Way
it
back
was,
when.
Right, Gary.
No, way back when.
Right.
Yeah.
So do you think they would be able to move production to North America?
I don't think production would be a problem at all, but I just think that, I mean, you begin to have shipping costs and logistics issues and things like that. And
well, you do anyway,
would,
out of
but,
Australia.
But I mean, but that would... I mean, but if you think about it, though, is that... A lot of what was being shipped from Australia, things like the SS and
the G8 and the GTO.
I mean, those were comparatively small volumes, and you were able to get a premium on those cars, right? So if you're General Motors now, do you produce everything you can in the former Daewoo plants in South Korea and send them down to Australia because it's closer? Or do you say, oh, we're going to build them in, you know, Fairfax, Kansas, and ship them way the hell on the other side of the world? I think that would be too expensive. And so the Australians couldn't afford to do that, right? I mean, if you're trying to buy a car over there and no longer have local sourcing.
But, you know, John, you were telling me earlier today that when they first started some of this stuff, it was what, 50 cents on the dollar?
Yeah, I went to Australia in the year 2000, and the Australian dollar was worth 50 cents compared to the American dollar.
Yeah.
Now they're at about parity. So
if they build them here, the shipping costs may not be, you know, may not be that big of a barrier to send those cars, you know, do a right-hand drive version at Oshawa and send the V8 cars down to Australia, and maybe even keep the Utes going, and, you know, maybe we'll see an El Camino in the U.S.
Maybe. Well, I looked it up, and Holden's building around 80 to 90,000 cars a year right now. It's been higher in the past. It's been lower in the past, but it's around 80, 90,000. And that's not too far off, a little bit behind, but not too far off the volume for the Camaro right now. So that's a nice chunk of volume. And Oshawa, to your point, Matt, is where they used to make the Camaro. They've since moved it to Michigan. So I don't know if they've got open capacity at the plant.
Yeah.
But they know how to build. I mean, that line has been tooled up to be able to drive, build rear drive cars.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think capacity is not at all a problem in North America for anyone.
For anyone, yeah.
What else is going on?
Well, we got the news today. Volkswagen sacked their Volkswagen of America president, Jonathan Browning, which I think was totally predictable.
Because they want to churn those sales.
Well, yeah, nothing against Jonathan. I think the guy was a competent, excuse me, manager. But, you know, here's the U.S. market rocking good. I mean, we're going to do, what, by the end of the year, 15.6 million vehicles, and everybody's up, but Volkswagen, they're down. And, you know, I know the VW culture. You don't hit your numbers. That's the end of your career. So I didn't think it would come this soon, but they didn't even wait till the end of the year. He's gone. I don't even know anything about the guy they're replacing him with.
Michael Horn joined Volkswagen in 1990, became the head of sales of Northwest Europe from 97, head of sales and marketing premium class vehicles of the Volkswagen brand from 2001, and head of sales for Europe from 2004. In 2009, appointed head of Volkswagen Global After Sales. What is that?
After sales is what we call aftermarket.
So what would Volkswagen Global Aftermarket be?
That's selling like roof racks and special wheels and
things that hang from rearview mirrors. No.
Yeah, yeah.
Air freshener.
Hula bobble girls.
Yeah.
Yeah. But after sales is everything, you know, once you sold the
Peter,
car.
Peter, you're bitching about Mary Barra. I mean, yeah. Come on.
Well, the other thing, going back to GM, Alan Beatty getting.
Who Mark Royce brought from Australia after Mark came back from running Australia, he brought Alan Beatty here.
Well, I see that as a curious move because Beatty's a marketing guy. And
well, he's a sales guy.
Sales guy. Okay. Sales guy. Which is good, but can he run operations? I guess we're gonna find out.
Yeah.
But to me, that's almost the biggest roll of the dice. Now, you know, look, he's got Royce. If they're pals, Mark will help him out and everything. Probably be a great mentor to him. But I thought that was an interesting move. And I don't know him well enough, you know, to say, yeah, I'm really impressed by this guy or not. But to put a sales guy in charge of operations, that usually doesn't happen.
Yeah. Well, hell, they just shut down all the operations in his country. I mean, they can't send him back.
And talking about, you know, who's getting moved around, supposedly today Ford Motor Company had a board meeting and reportedly the whole board is up in arms wanting to know, is Mullally going to stay or is he going to go?
Okay, so I saw today you reported or you said you believe that Mullally is
going to
Microsoft.
I believe.
So in there's this woman, Kara Swisher, she writes for this site called All Things D. So this is Walter Mossberg of Wall Street Journal and then Kara, and they put this thing together and they're gonna spin out and they're gonna start their own company. So they're tech people, okay? So they're really into it. And Kara reports today, or writes today, because after I read your thing, I started searching around a little bit. And Now, a couple of weeks ago, she wrote a piece saying that she thought that Mullally was going to be the guy who was going to get the position at Microsoft. And she said the plus for Mullally, an obvious ability to manage a complex organization with many moving parts and masses of employees. The minus, he's not enough of a visionary geek who can grok the massive changes moving through the digital landscape and also understand the complexity of the tech itself. In other words, he can't program, he doesn't Snapchat, but he sure can give a corker of a speech. Okay, she was for him. But she says, over the last week, Mullally's star has fallen quickly, which sources said is due to some shift in opinion among Microsoft's directors that perhaps a more tech-experienced exec is needed with major chops in either the enterprise or consumer arenas. Not helping Mullally was what happened to be an off-the-cuff, what appeared to be an off-the-cuff statement by Ford Chairman Edsel Ford II, who told Bloomberg News that Mullally has, quote, told us that his plan is to stay with Ford through the end of 2014, close quote. Although Mullally still gave a non-denial of his interest, Ford's remarks sent Microsoft stock tumbling. This perceived jockeying was not well received by many inside Microsoft, and some felt it was Mullally trying to hedge the situation on both sides a little too much. Sources inside Microsoft also note that Mullally's candidacy has languished on other issues, including how long he'd remain CEO and also control over board dynamics. So maybe not, Alan.
So maybe not. I still stick by what I said. Then that was, when the rumors first surfaced, I said, no way is he going to go. You know, he's 67 years old at the time and now 68. He's got more money than he can physically spend. He's proven everything he's got to do. So I said, no way is he going to go to Microsoft. But in the last month, in a couple of press conferences and interviews, when he's been asked, are you going to Microsoft? He's danced around it. He dodged the question. And that's when I said, this guy's going. Because if you're not going, you go, no, I'm not going. I'm sticking with Ford, and then I'm retiring. But when you start dancing around, hemming and hawing, and that's when I said, this guy's gone. Now, the only thing is that's interesting as you read that is remember when Ford first went after him, he told him, no, I'm not going. And he even later admitted that as he's telling Ford, no, I'm not going to leave Boeing and go to Ford. In his mind, he's saying, what are you saying? Yeah. Of course you want to go. So I wonder if this is a tough decision and, you know, he's maybe conflicted himself as to what he wants to do. But I stick to what I say. When top-level executives start dancing around a question, you know something's going on.
Something's up.
And it's not what they're telling you. Something else is going on. So that's why I think...
See, but they're throwing out there, Sheryl Sandberg, CEO of Facebook, may do it. And so you'd say to yourself, that might make more logical sense. She's well-known in the tech industry. She's well-known outside the tech industry for her Lean Forward book about women in the workplace. So, you know, it's all coming back. It's all part of the thing.
Of course, Alan's thing is he didn't know anything about the car industry, which is not entirely true. He knew some things, but...
Well, he was a student of the whole Toyota...
The lean production.
Lean production, and he learned all about that from Lou Veraldi, who ran the original Team Taurus program. Right. So there had been Boeing-Ford connections as well as Boeing-Toyota connections. But Alan's magic is he knows how to get people focused on a plan that they help put together and then let them go, but follow up with these Thursday morning meetings. And I have no doubt he could do the same thing for Microsoft.
Okay, but think about this for a minute, though. He's at Boeing, and what do they do? What does Boeing do?
Manufacture.
But what do they manufacture?
Airplanes.
And that's all they manufacture, right? Airplanes. What does Ford do?
Same, but cars.
But cars. What does Microsoft do?
Same, but software. And
Xboxes.
Yeah.
And they bought Nokia, and, you know, they were in the music business for a while. That didn't work out so well. They do enterprise software, which is completely different than the software that we run. You know, we're sitting here and we all have our iPads, but let's not forget they also manufacture the Surface. So my point is that Microsoft is a company that you just can't say, okay, this is going to be one Microsoft and we're going to do it like one Ford, and we're going to focus on building the best cars in the world, because they have to build the best enterprise software. They have to do the best desktop software. They've got to compete with Apple on the tablets. They've got to, you know, compete with Sony and Nintendo on the Xboxes. You know what I mean? They've got all of these things going, so it's sort of a different world. It's not a apple.
Yeah,
apple
but you know,
comparison.
Ford, when he got there, yeah, okay, they're all building cars, but you had all these disparate regional, you know, entities: Ford of Europe, Ford Latin America, blah 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 blah. Everybody sort of knew what they had to do, but no one could come to a consensus. No one had the guts to you know, put their career on the line and say, this is what we've got to do. And Alan was able to go in there. They all knew what they had to do. Nobody had the guts or the capability of doing it. And he pulled that all together. I'll bet the same thing's going on at Microsoft.
Yeah.
I think we'll probably know before the end of the year.
And the end of the year is right around the corner.
Texas job myself.
Texas. The Texas job. What's that?
The University of Texas.
Oh. Coach.
Hey, why don't we take a break, which we've got to do, a quick one here, and we'll come back and get into some of the other stuff to talk about. So, Ben, let's give some time to our friends at Firestone.
Introducing a car company that's never made a single car. We took the power of a 9-year-old V8 and gave it the impressive handling of Firestone's destination tire. Now, moms agree, every milk run feels like a victory lap. So whatever you drive, drive a Firestone.
This January, AutoLine covers the North American International Auto Show like never before. During press days on Monday and Tuesday, the 13th and 14th, AutoLine Live will talk to the executives who made the biggest news and unveiled the hottest products at the Detroit show. But the coverage doesn't stop there. Stay with us on both Wednesday and Thursday, the 15th and 16th, when we are live from Industry Days as the supplier community comes to Cobo Hall and AutoLine Live to discuss the vital issues driving today's industry. For the most comprehensive coverage of the North American International Auto Show, there's only one place to turn: AutoLine.tv.
Well, there was other news this week, and we got the finalists for the North American Car and Truck of the Year. And some of the big news is General Motors dominating the list, really. Yep. I mean, what do you think about that, Matt? It sort of ties in with what you were talking about, them being
well,
a
they're on
the product roll.
Like Peter was saying, they're on quite a product roll right now. And, you know, Corvette and CTS made the car finalists, and then Silverado on the truck side. So, you know, they've stepped up. You know, you can't argue against good product, and it certainly shows.
Yeah, I've been...
What are the trucks, the Silverado, the...
Jeep Cherokee and the Acura MDX.
Yeah.
And I like all the choices. The only thing that I felt we missed it on as one of the Nakode jurors is... the Fiesta ST didn't make the list, and that's one of my favorite cars that's come out this year.
Yeah, I'm kind of surprised, too.
In fact, you know, somebody was saying that, well, Ford never made, they made the ST available for all of us to drive, but I don't know anybody who's driven a regular Fiesta, and they've made numerous improvements to it. I got a like an hour drive this summer in it at an event that Ford did in Dearborn, but... That's what I've heard from other jurors is, well, we never got a chance to drive the car. How can we possibly vote for this as car of the year?
Yeah, yeah.
Which is a shame, though, because the ST is, to me, a sensational car.
Yeah, it's fun. It's fun. It's weird because Ford, I think they've done a lot to get their house in order, but there's still a lot of stuff. They're still flying under the radar in a lot of segments. You know, Lincoln's still a mess. And, you know, I give Mullally a lot of credit, you know, for what he's been able to do. But it'll be interesting to see what his legacy is when you look back where you see Ford ending up in 5 or 10 years and see, you know, were there other things that they could have done during this period to make it a better company, and they just didn't do it, you know?
I don't know. I'd be hard-pressed to find anything that they could have much done differently in a big way to affect the company 5 to 10 years down the road. Yeah. I mean, you're right. Lincoln is a mess, but they're working on it. And it's just going to take billions of dollars and years. That's all.
Yeah.
If it works.
Right, right. But you think they would have gotten started sooner? I mean, well, how many times did they reinvent Lincoln?
Well, first things first, and that's how they put it. You know, first we're going to fix Ford. And when we know that's on a path that's going to be good in the future, then we'll turn our attention to Lincoln.
Well, let me ask you guys, do you think any of the divestitures of Volvo, Land Rover, and Jag were a mistake, or were they needed?
Well, that's sort of two questions, though, because, I mean, you have the issue of, okay, they needed money and they needed to do something. Now, was that the best way to get the money? I mean, I personally think they should have kept Volvo. I think that in the same reason I always thought that General Motors should have kept Opel because of engineering, just straight out engineering. You know, forget the fact that Volvo sales were like this. I mean, somehow we're able to find Lincoln just fine and its sales are like this. I mean, the aforementioned Camaro is outselling all of Lincoln this year, just the Camaro, okay? So, you know, you had all these guys in Gothenburg, you know, really smart guys who knew safety technology forward, backwards, and upside down and every which way. Plus, the Volvo guys were way ahead of lots of people in terms of technology. I mean, in terms of putting cars together. I mean, they were laser welding cars before Volkswagen was doing it. And Volkswagen now is, you know, thought to be the company that does it better than everybody. And then General Motors now, like if you're looking at a lot of the new cars, like, you know, the ATS, that if you notice at the top, there's no ditch weld up there anymore because basically they're laser welding and then they're just brazing that and it's nice and smooth and no strip. And so, I mean, so they have Volvo. So, you know, do you need to sell it to get cash? Obviously they did, but would I have done that? I don't think they should have. But
see, to me, it wasn't selling Volvo or Jaguar Land Rover or Aston to get money. It was to not have to invest billions more in them. Because they didn't get much of anything for Volvo, right?
They couldn't do it and not take care of what they needed to do in Ford. They just didn't have any choice. They couldn't. The investment is the key. They couldn't afford to spend the money to do what was needed on those brands.
That's how I see it.
I think you're right.
And, you know, look at now the company's really profitable. They are working on fixing Lincoln. They're a good decade or more behind GM turning Cadillac around. I mean, look, Cadillac's been at it over a decade. It's only just starting to come together now. And that's why I say all it takes is billions of dollars and lots of years. Because it's not just a matter of getting the product right. It's getting the product right for several generations. And that's when the public starts to go, hey, that Cadillac looks pretty good. You know, it takes that long. You know,
it's been 16 years since they showed the original Evoque concept at Cobo. I mean, 16 years. I mean, and they're still not there. I mean, they've done great stuff, but sustaining it over generations, that's a whole nother thing.
Yeah. Well, you know, I love telling the story in the 1920s when General Motors decided it was going to knock Packard off as the top luxury car in America. It took them 20 years to do it. Mm-hmm. And there was no Lexus, Infiniti, you know, BMW, you know, they just had to go after one brand. Lincoln was, you know, even much smaller then than it is today. So that's what it takes. It's not just a matter of getting the product perfect. You got to do that, but you got to do it for a couple of generations before the public even starts to notice.
Mm-hmm. I don't think the public will notice Lincoln until there's a Continental.
A big,
I mean, the name resonates, you know, they just need a big car. And once they do, now I will say, I think the MKC is going to be very strong.
Very successful.
Very successful in market. I think they, you know, that's going to be a hit.
In fact, I would think something like that could do, 30, 40,000 units a year, something like that?
This is the RDX, I think, is the leader in that segment right now, and they're at 34, I believe, thousand. So,
but you look at those types of vehicles,
the Audi and the X3, their numbers are not so high.
No, but I think the Q5 has been a pretty good hit for Audi.
No, it has, absolutely.
And so once you're in that space, and getting to Volkswagen, I think that's one of the things that's killing them. They have nothing between the Tiguan and the Touareg in the price thing.
Right. And they know it. I mean, at every auto show, they're trotting out their future SUVs and crossovers that are coming. And that's a big hole in their lineup.
But I recently saw a Mule MKC driving in downtown Plymouth. And I mean, I'd seen the car, you know, at auto show and, you know, the preview in New York. And, you know, so you see it in a room. And I was not that all taken. You know, I was just like, so what? I saw it driving. It looks great. I mean, even with all the, you know, all the camo paint on it and stuff like that. I mean, just the roof line. I mean, it really, really looks good in the real world, you know, inside a room. But boy, I was impressed.
It was interesting at the LA show. There were only two, and this was during the press day. So I don't know if it was true during the public days, but on the press days, they only had two vehicles on the Lincoln stand, the MKZ and the MKC. They had four of, you know, each of them. No MKS, no MKT, and I, you know.
I'll bet that was for press days.
Remember,
a year ago, they had nothing but classic Lincolns from the 20s and 30s and 40s, even 50s.
Yeah.
So I wouldn't be surprised if Ford wants us in the media to forget the T, you know, the MKT, the, you know, MKS and whatnot, and just put their best foot forward in front of the media.
Yeah. But I agree with Peter. I just think that they need a big statement car. They need to make that Continental. And then also they gave up the livery car business. I mean, they're trying to make it with that MKT, but they're just not having
In fact,
it.
They're calling the MKT the town car for that livery.
Right.
It actually works great for that, but they have trouble getting the livery people to sign up for it.
But I did not know that the new Mustang is an all-new platform, all-new rear drive platform, independent rear suspension. Right. Hey, there's your underpinnings for a rear drive Lincoln.
Sure.
And there's no way they tooled up a whole new platform to sell 80,000 Mustangs a year.
No,
there's more coming off that.
There's got to be something coming. So,
No, there is.
Yeah.
But is it the Halo Lincoln or is it more like a new Lincoln LS? You know, the last rear drive midsize sedan they had.
Oh, I think it's going to have to be a statement car. I mean, Cadillac is just, I mean, Cadillac, at least the design point of view of Cadillac is very strong. And it's starting to resonate with people. And, you know, the light, people talk about the light signature of the new CTS at night. I mean,
it looks cool at night.
Yeah.
Man does it.
So, you know, if Ford wants Lincoln to survive, they're going to have to. Now, they can't emulate the we're going to go around the Nürburgring as fast as the Germans. I mean, Cadillac's beaten that to death. But there's nothing wrong with just being a nice American luxury car.
Yeah. So what comes first, the big Cadillac or the big Lincoln?
I think they're going to be out at about the same time, actually.
Which probably wouldn't be a bad thing.
No.
You know?
No, that'd be a good thing, actually, for both of them. Because then the buzz will be, look what the Americans are doing in the luxury segment.
And the two guys I would hate to be in the room when that happens would be Lexus and Infiniti.
Yeah, because they'll get hammered.
That's what basically killed.
Well, remember, we had Jeff Bracken sitting in that chair last week, the guy running Lexus in the U.S., and he said, we're going upscale.
Well, I think that's the right move for them.
And he said, we'll see it in Detroit.
Right.
He wouldn't say, is it like an LFLC or CC sports car? Or is it going to be a big sedan?
Yeah, but if you look at the sales of the LS, their, you know, LS 460, their big car, those sales are going down.
It's old. It doesn't.
Well, I mean, but if you look at S class sales and that whole strata is beginning.
It's a small market.
It's
anyway.
Beginning to contract, and you've got a lot of competition there. I mean, the S class. What a wonderful car that they came out with. How many are they going to sell?
Not many.
So,
it's a
statement.
To being the Halo car.
Statement.
Yeah. Well, and that's the thing, though. You're going to get, especially with the Cadillac and the Lincoln, you're going to get an S-Class car size at an E-Class price.
Yeah.
That's the other big difference, you know, and that's.
And frankly,
that's what they
the
need.
American consumer's
ready for. Yeah.
Yeah.
Where's the LS in its product cycle? The Lexus LS is it up?
I think it's
in another year for a redo.
I think they just had a mid-cycle refresh.
On.
Yeah,
didn't they just
the
put
spindle,
the, new,
the spindle grill? But they did some other things to it, so I think it's like mid-cycle.
So it will not be, I'm guessing, LS upscale LS for Detroit.
I thought it was going to be that coupe,
that sports car.
Yeah.
That they did layer by layer, or whatever made some crazy claim about. It'd be more performance oriented.
Okay.
But there's a new Genesis coming. There's the Kia K900.
Isn't there a new Equus?
Yeah.
They're going to show an Equus concept.
Yeah. Equus is coming. Oh,
so,
and I expect that to look really good.
I expect that. I mean, we're right on the verge here with the design talent that Hyundai and Kia has hired. We're right on the verge now of they're starting to really come into market with them. So it's going to be interesting because I expect the new Equus to be hot.
Yeah, I think that was a smart move, making Peter Schreier in charge of both studios. Because I always felt when I looked at the Hyundai product, it was just not, you know, it's just a little.
But remember what happened? You know, you had Joel Piskowski, and he did the current Sonata, which set the whole design direction. Then boom, he was gone.
Yeah.
And I think that vision of where to take that look up and down the line got lost once he left. Joel's at Ford right now. Right. In fact, didn't he do
did the Mustang?
He led the Mustang design.
What do you guys think of the Mustang?
I like it. I think it looks really good. I mean, I wondered if they could have reached a little more with it. Mm-hmm. But I think for 99% of the people out there, it looks like a cool Mustang.
So where would you have gone with it, Peter?
I would just gone. I think it's very nice. I mean, when you see the details of it, it's very nice. It just
looks better in person.
Much better in person. Much better. I don't know. I just would have gone maybe a little more radical. I mean, the coolest thing they did in Dearborn is they had all these Mustangs from all the years, but the coolest to me still is the Mustang One.
Yeah.
The little mid-engine
one. Mid-engine car.
And boy, is it little.
It's
I mean,
tiny.
The small car. You know, but everything looks tiny by today's standards.
Yeah.
It really does. But I mean, God, what's it got? Like 13-inch wheels?
Oh, yeah. They were Lotus wheels off a Lotus Formula car. And it had crucified for this, but I think it had a V4 Cardinal engine from England. But it was just very cool.
But it looks cool. Totally. I'd love to drive.
What it did for Ford back then was it just inspired the designers to go off. Did the new Mustang look like it? Not really. But there were elements that came from that car that's, you know, they're still using today. Are we ready for rapid fire?
Why don't we get into rapid fire? We got a bunch of questions coming in right now. So the first question comes from A.M. Guerrero in Metro Manila in the Philippines. He says, the first-gen Mustangs and the current retro Mustang are popular outside North America. Do you guys think this is the reason why Ford decided to retain some retro Mustang styling elements on the Global 2015 model?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, yep, there's certain design cues that they weren't going to mess with.
Well, no. I think they would have chased all the designers out of the building with flaming torches had they not maintained some retro styling in that car. I mean, it's a Mustang.
You have to. I mean, you're dealing with a legacy there, so you don't just, you know, show up and do a Genesis and hang a pony on it.
Yeah.
Right?
They were going to try and do
Joel
that with
used,
the probe.
Joel used his skills. Yeah. It's just like, hey, guys, I got one of these.
Right.
Yeah.
I know you guys know the answer to this one, but Norbert wants to know, with all this talk about world launches for the Mustang and one Ford, will Mustang be available in right-hand drive, or will they continue to ignore one-third of the world?
You know, I never heard that.
Yeah. They're going to have a right-hand
drive.
Yeah,
I'm assuming they're going to have a right-hand
drive. Yeah, they are. Wright Knight says, with a higher production cost in Australia, why not build a premium line of cars there? Well, they kind of did.
Those,
you know, the the Holden cars were sold in the Middle East as premium, in China as premium, in the United States as premium. And I got to believe they're probably some of the most expensive cars in Australia, too.
Yeah, but as you said, John, they just don't, it's just not a big enough market.
It's volume. Yeah. It's volume. Australia is just not big enough. Autoline after our guest,
John, 680. This is thinking of large factories. I think you need to rethink that position.
You're going to pull Thomas Crum on me now, aren't you? You might be right, Gary. Okay, Autoline guest 686 wants to know, any word on what the Audi concept will be at NAIAS, as well as any other concept?
I thought they were showing the Q1.
You know, it's funny because they've shown this concept, and then I've been reading online and stuff, and they're like, oh yeah, it's the concept's going to preview the next Audi TT. And I look at the sketch that these guys are saying, this could preview the next TT. And I look and I go, no, that's the Q1.
Oh, by the way, though, that's a good point. There's something very interesting going on. And I was working on this column before GM blowed up real good. But Audi is going ahead and flat out saying that this small crossover is the redefinition of the sports car. And if that's what's happening, then hell is freezing over.
Oh, yeah. Because, God help us all.
Yeah, because the manufacturers, I think, are jumping on this and saying, yes, small crossovers are the redefinition of the sports cars. And all you people out there who think of, you know, like little roadsters and stuff, you're over. Because now we're going to call these sports cars. And I was just like, oh, man.
The Macan is like that. I mean, that's kind of what Porsche's doing.
Yeah, there's the Q1 up there. But, Audi flat out says it's the redefinition. It's a small sports car. And I'm just like, oh, boy.
Yeah, I don't know. I'll have to see or drive this
thing.
There
is no way, shape, or form a crossover to... An enthusiast is going to say, oh, yeah, it's a sports car. No, that's not going to happen.
They shouldn't even say that.
They shouldn't say it.
We are putting sport in this utility.
That's why
don't call it a sports car.
They flat out say it's a sports car, and that's what I was writing my column on until the news came.
Joseph N. wants to know, should we believe that Mary being picked was in the cards at GM for some time?
Yes, I think.
Sometime, but how much?
Well, I think Ackerson had it in his mind a year ago.
Yeah. And I think that, and you probably noticed this as well, that at press events or things that she sort of had a very high visibility and was really, surprisingly out there. I remember last year when they did the program out in San Francisco for the, they were talking about their electrification. And they had all their electrification people, but then they had Mary in on a satellite feed talking about what, you know, General Motors was doing. And it just seemed
there was a real syrupy puff piece done in a local publication here, Our Magazine, mm-hmm. in Detroit last spring. And it was a real puff piece. But in it, he said he was going to be the champion of promoting women. He flat out said it. So, yeah, no, this has been coming.
Mario Paredes from New York City says, has anyone from the panel driven the Ram 1500 EcoDiesel? Should GM be worried that the Silverado's not winning a lot of accolades since it's the most updated truck of the big three?
I drove it. Did you drive it?
No.
So I drove it back to back with the Hemi version and then that version. And the thing that surprised me was that when I've driven diesel cars, that, you know, you have all that low end torque and, you know, you just push back in your seat and it's, you know, very exhilarating and just really a nice feel. And when I was driving the Eco Diesel, I was just shocked that I wasn't getting that. And, you know, then you get in the Hemi and you do it and boom, right? And so I talked to one of the engineers on the program and I said, you know, because all my colleagues are saying how torquey the engine is and how great it was, and I'm feeling like, gee, I must be a moron. And I said, I'm not feeling it. And he goes, no, we calibrated that engine purely for fuel economy. We didn't calibrate that engine for torque. If you want torque, we've got the Hemi. If you want fuel economy, we've got the Eco Diesel. Should GM be worried about that from that point of view? Well, I don't think so, because they're getting really good fuel economy out of their engines.
And I think the point about the accolades is, you know, okay, the Ram truck has won Motor Trend Truck of the Year 2 years in a row. The silver, you know, the Ram truck was not eligible this year for North American Truck of the Year, because the panel felt that there wasn't enough change. It was just an engine option rather than an all-new vehicle. So, you know, Silverado still could win Truck of the Year. And I'm sure that they'll pick up a couple of other awards along the way as the year unfolds.
Well, it's a good truck. It's a really good truck. But, you know, when I drove the Ram when it came out, I went, wow, wow.
Yeah.
And when I drive the Silverado, I go, this is a really,
really good truck. Yeah.
I mean, A plus to GM, but it didn't exceed my expectations like the Ram did.
So we'll see what the new F-150 is like.
Yeah, we'll see.
Yeah, yeah.
Steve, speaking of the Silverado, Steve Hafazula says, I've had many sleepless nights wondering how the GM 4.3 Ecotec 3 V6 can operate in four-cylinder mode. Wouldn't that throw the engine off balance and cause rough idle? The only way I can think to do this is to fire three cylinders at once and then the other three cylinders 360 degrees later. I don't know how that works.
That's why they have computers.
Yeah.
That's why they have engineers.
Yes.
Yeah.
I can't say I've driven that engine. I've driven the V8 in V4 mode,
right,
and it's very smooth. But this is a good question.
Well, okay. It'd be just like having a V4. There'd probably be two cylinders that they don't fire.
Dr. Botox wants to know, who will pay $35,000 for a diesel Colorado? Is that what they're talking price-wise? $35,000 for a Colorado?
I don't know. I
don't think they've talked any price.
Isn't that diesel not going to be out until 2016, I think?
I think
you're
right.
Yeah, and the other thing we were talking about, these trucks are too big. I mean, the manufacturer that does a real compact pickup in this market and prices it right, I think would sell them like gangbusters.
The one that's never been built and I've been waiting for is the M80,
yeah,
the Dodge concept, you know. Get back to where those first Japanese, and talk about sports car. Sport compact trucks were back in the
day. They were hot.
They were hot.
And if you're going to do a compact pickup, it should be like that. But, Colorado and the Can, these are big vehicles. These are like what the old full-size pickup trucks would be like. Well, maybe 15 years ago, whatever, but
yeah,
they're big.
RMT1 says, why doesn't Lincoln just add a couple of inches to their wheelbases to differentiate themselves from Ford? This would change the proportions enough so they wouldn't just be rebadged Fords.
I think you're going to see that in their upcoming products a lot. The MKC looks dramatically different than the Escape.
Oh, you don't even
You don't even think they're the same.
Right.
So you're going to be seeing that.
The one thing I will say is to add a few more inches to the wheelbase is a big tooling proposition.
Yeah, you just don't get the saber saws out.
Yeah.
Go out in the back.
Right. Well, put some angle iron in there.
It can be done. I mean, I was at, you know, the Port Elizabeth plant in Holden, and they pioneered a lot of this stuff. They used one body shop for two different wheelbases, and they just had a different, you know, armature to hold the longer wheelbase. And it can be done.
It can be done. But, I mean, you're talking about stamping out different floor pans, different body side apertures, different rear doors, different roof.
Right.
And it's not that expensive, but you're talking millions and millions of dollars.
Right.
So it's not like just stretch it a little bit and you're there.
Right.
Even though that's exactly what the livery guys do for these stretch limos.
Sure.
Well,
but they look horrible.
Remind me of the scene of Animal House when they decided to build take the Continental and build a float. They just start.
But you know what? If they want to command a premium price for Lincoln and have it as an upscale alternative to Ford, they got to do that.
But
you just can't slap a badge.
Just think about the little things that end up being affected by that. I mean, all the wiring harnesses have to change. Yeah. I mean, you just, you know, it's just stuff you don't even see.
It's a big deal.
Think about, you know, the tubing, the whole, you know, it's just.
You know, there are a lot of manufacturers have had experience doing that in China. You know, you look at that. There's long wheelbase versions of the Passat and the 5 Series and stuff that we don't see in China. It's common.
It's common, and that's where they will spend the money because they will sell the models to cover that tooling cost.
So they get the volume that you might not be able to get here, and therefore it'd be very hard to pay for. They'd be better off just saying, okay, we're going to go in our own direction.
S10 Baja wants to know, just wondering if GM design from now on will have many versions of each model or car or truck, like the Camaro has a base car, the SS, the ZL1, etc. He goes on to say, I don't think every model should have a performance version, but the old Colorado just had a sticker package as the Z71, and they just kind of phoned it in on design. So should they have different models?
I think it depends on the model. I mean, clearly the Camaro lends itself to that because they have so many great, you know,
I think in the Colorado,
Malibus,
you'll see off-road versus on-road type of packages and things like that. I think even Royce mentioned that and said the fact that they're really looking at putting a manual in one of the models too.
The thing is, if you do it on performance cars like the Camaro or the Corvette, and you know there's various models of Corvette, is even though there's not a big tooling change, you're adding a lot of cool hardware, a lot more performance, either in the powertrain or suspension or whatnot, and customers will pay for that. And you can charge a lot of money. So to try to do, you know, all kinds of variations of a Malibu, Yowza, maybe if you do it on a global basis, you can have a coupe, a sedan, a wagon, a convertible, but it's got to be global or you can't pay for it. Maybe we'll.
I always like the Aztec Rally package.
Gary, where do you come up with this stuff?
Collectible.
Let's see. Let's make this the last one. And Peter, this goes to you. It's from Anthony DeFormoni. I probably butchered the name, but he says, "How do you feel about the Tudor Sports Car Championship possibly reaching its entry limit of 60 cars?" I don't even know. Explain what that is. I don't even know what this is.
That's the combined
Grand
Am and Am.
Sponsored
by Tudor Watches, which is the
entry level Rolex.
affiliate brand of Rolex. I think it's good. I think the optimism reigns right now, and you know, there's going to be a huge entry list at Daytona. But then, as the year progresses, you know, teams run out of money and. But there's a core, solid core of competitors for the series. So, you know, I'm optimistic right now. I wish them the best. I mean, we need Major League Road Racing in this country, and I hope they succeed.
Yeah. We need cars that look like what you can buy in the showroom kind of race.
So I hope it succeeds.
Good. Well, probably a good time to wrap this up. I will want to remind everybody who's watching and listening that we're doing our Autoline Executive of the Year. I've put together a top-level panel of automotive experts to choose who we think is the top automotive executive this year.
It's going to be very interesting.
Very interesting. We'll announce it December 20th. That's a Friday. Just to go through it quickly, I've got Marianne Keller, former Wall Street analyst, Dr. David Cole, who started the Center for Automotive Research, Neil DeCoker, who ran the Original Equipment Supplier Association, Carl Ludvigsen, author, lecturer, former auto exec himself, who's been on this show, and Ed Lapham, now retired, but former managing editor of Automotive News. And we've been debating for a couple of months now who's the best. We're going to announce it a week from, I should say December 20th. So stay tuned for that. But Matt DeLorenzo, thanks for coming in from California, man. It's great having you on the show.
Great being here.
And Gary Vasilash, Automotive Design and Production, always good having you on.
Thank you, John.
And Peter, great discussion, man. Let's do it again next week.
Yes, we will.
Auto Line After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone, your journey, our passion.
Visit our website, autoline.tv, where you can watch us live Thursday nights at 6 p.m. Eastern. Get your daily news fix with Autoline Daily and in-depth analysis and interviews with Autoline This Week. There's all that and much more at autoline.tv.